blood turns brown on fabric. The photo in the court file shows a thin smear on a curtain by a broken window. Years later, it still anchors the case, because testing matched it to the man who came through that opening. The house sits back from the road in rural Noble County. No traffic hum. No neighbors in sight. The phone line had been cut outside. Inside, drawers were open. A television and a VCR were gone. Silverware, too. On the bed, an 86-year-old woman lay still with a pillow near her face. Her daughter-in-law found her the next day. The first report reads like hundreds of burglaries that turn worse. This one did not fade. It waited. For 4 years, the file moved between shelves and hands. Leads rose and fell. The curtain detail never changed. The lab said the blood on that fabric came from the intruder. The entry was the back window. The line outside was cut first. The route in was quiet and fast. The scene was tight. No spray. No struggle that left a map. A pillow can end a life without sound. It is as personal as hands. It is also hard to prove without the story that sits behind it. In 2000, the story arrived in an interview room when a girlfriend named a name and gave detectives a path to a box of silverware in a mother's home. On the next day, in a different room, the man at the center sat down and gave a version of events that matched the cut line, the broken glass, the missing items, and the pillow. The curtain did the rest. A jury listened in 2002 and returned two words that closed doors. The next winter, the sentence fixed the rest of his life. Years later, the state's highest court weighed the record. It left the verdict and the sentence in place. Opinions speak in careful lines, but one line stands out in this case. Blood on a curtain where a man climbed in. From that fabric to a life term, the arc is clean and hard. This is the story of how a quiet house and a small stain held steady while time moved on. How a cold file warmed the room again, and how a town marked the end of an old fear with a single detail that never blinked. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave a comment. The next story might change your mind. Don't miss a single turn. The phone line lay cut outside the house. A back window was broken for entry. Inside, an elderly woman was dead. These points sit at the top of the file for September 1996 in rural Noble County, Indiana. Body content. I walk the record the way I would a scene. The entry point comes first. The glass broke at the back window. The intruder went in there, not at a door, not at a front window. The choice tells me he wanted cover. The house sits off the road. No close neighbors. A back approach lowers risk and noise. The cut phone line confirms planning. He took away the call for help before he went inside. The phone sits silent while he moves room to room. This order matters because it sets intent. He secured the quiet, then he entered. The inventory in the opinion reads like a simple list. A television, a VCR, silverware, credit cards and checks. Each item fits a quick pass, not a long haul. He did not bring a truck for furniture. He took what he could carry fast. The pattern is a burglary that turns into a murder inside a small window of time. The list is useful for scope. It is also useful later when those same items surface again, tagged and bagged with addresses and dates. But at this stage, I only mark what is missing and where the gaps show up in the rooms. The file notes say the victim's body was found the next day by a family member. I flag the interval between the last known contact and discovery. That span defines the pool of potential witnesses for sounds or lights that night. It also affects time of death estimates. In this case, the cause is simple and brutal. A pillow held over the face ends breath fast and leaves little noise. There is no muzzle flash to chase. There are no casings to map. A pillow gives hands control and keeps the room quiet. The method tells me the intruder could stand close without fear of a shot drawing anyone to the house. It also suggests he did not come armed, or he chose silence over metal. The court record states the suffocation plainly. I keep my language the same. In photographs, a curtain near the broken window carries a stain. The opinion later turns that stain into a fixed point. For me, in chapter one, it is a scene note. Fabric where skin passes is a surface that can take blood. The path in and out runs through that frame. The latch, the sill, the hang of the cloth, all sit at reach height. If the intruder cut himself on glass at the climb, transfer is likely. The house did not create that blood. The scene did not make it by chance. It comes from a person who moved through that opening. When a lab ties a name to a stain like this, the room becomes a witness that does not change its story. The Indiana Supreme Court used one line to capture the point. His blood was found on a curtain where he gained entrance. Three scene details matter now and only now. First sequence. Outside first, inside second. Cut the line. Break the glass. Enter. This order shows planning and an effort to prevent a call. It also reduces the chance of a fight at a door. The intruder wanted a window and the cover of the back of the house. I fix that sequence so later testimony does not blur it. Second selection. He took electronics, flatware, and financial instruments. No large items. This is speed over value. The mix hints at a burglar who knows how to move small goods fast. Silverware can be given as a gift or sold without a pawn ticket photo. Cards and checks can be used or fenced through someone else. A TV and VCR are common and easy to swap for cash in the late 1990s. The opinion lists these items together, which helps me treat them as a package rather than loose ends. Third method. A pillow on the face is close contact. It also aligns with a break-in that started without a weapon in hand. If the plan had been to shoot, a gun would appear in the record. It does not. The pillow tells me the fatal act happened inside a burglary that was already underway. It is a shift from property to violence when the victim encounters the intruder or when he decides to remove the witness. The court places the suffocation at some point during this episode, which is the narrowest honest phrasing for timing. I keep it that way. I log the house state as the file describes it. Drawers open. Items removed. No note of a ransacked home beyond what is needed to find the listed items. That matters because chaos can hide trace. Here the scene reads controlled. A fast pass in rooms, not a tear down. A controlled pass supports the silent method. It also supports the idea that the killer did not want to linger. He did what he came to do, then he left. The next day the body is found. That span sets decomposition signs and scene odor at discovery, but those details are not in the opinion, so I do not add them. I do not guess. I keep to the record. I study the window again. Entry points are tight stories. You can track where a hand must land to pull a sash or to steady a knee. The curtain is not an accident. Fabric sits where skin has to slide. The quote from the High Court may be a summary, but it compresses a lab chain and a set of photographs into a single sentence that a jury can hold. His blood. On that curtain. At that window. Where he came in. That is the arc the state leaned on later. For Chapter 1, I log it as the anchor on the physical side of this case. The room gives a quiet account. Cut line outside. Glass in the back. Missing items that fit a quick exit. A pillow used up close. A stain on a curtain right where a body had to pass. The house does not name a man. The fabric will. The next step in the file is the first time a person says the name that matches the stain. I open a blank floor plan and plot the route the record fixes. Disable the phone line outside, break the back window, enter, remove select items, exit. The opinion gives me each anchor point. I map only what the file supports. Body content. Sequence first. Timing sits inside one sentence from the court. Before entry, the phone line was cut. That detail matters because it shows preparation and control at the threshold, not a choice made inside the house. I note the sequence in the margin. Line first, glass second, room work third. The point of entry is fixed. He entered through a back window, which he broke to gain entry. I avoid guesswork about shards or direction of break. The record names the window and the act. The rear approach tells me he sought cover from the road and neighbors. That is the only safe inference tied to the sentence. I list the property the opinion names as removed. A television, a VCR, silverware, credit cards, and checks. These are portable, fast to lift, and easy to move. Nothing in the record adds furniture or larger items. I keep the inventory tight and complete as written. Room order is not described in the opinion. I do not assign it. The inventory crosses common spaces and the kitchen by type alone. I write a simple note to myself. No statement on which room came first. If later transcripts or reports fix a path, it belongs where those documents live in the outline. Here I hold the line. Known items only, no trail beyond what is written. The choice to cut the phone line before entry fits a plan to slow any call for help and any alarm that depends on a live line. The opinion does not describe a monitored system or a panic button or any failed outbound call at the moment of entry. So I do not claim one. I log the purpose as practical. Remove contact with the outside, then go in. the back window choice narrows approach and escape. A rear entry reduces light exposure and sight lines from the road. It also clusters trace to one aperture instead of a door with a broader frame and more touch points. The record confirms the window as the only named entry. I record it as the single gateway for this chapter. I flag how the inventory speaks to speed. A TV and VCR in the mid-1990s travel by arm, not by dolly in most burglaries of this type. Silverware moves in a bag or a box. Credit cards and checks fit a pocket. The mix aligns with a short stay. The opinion gives no time in-house estimate, so I do not add one. I let the property type stand for tempo. I write a margin rule for my later self. No claims about pried doors. No note about forced locks. No talk of shoe prints. No talk of glove use, unless a source beyond the opinion supplies it. Chapter 2 is the physical backbone from the High Court summary. The cut line, the broken rear window, the items taken. Nothing more here. I pause on the simple point that matters in court and in an audio telling. Entry method links to intent. A cut line before entry points to planning. A rear window points to stealth. The item list points to a focus on small goods. Those three together frame the act as a burglary with control at the edges. The homicide sits in a different sentence and a different chapter. I stay with the house and the break-in only. The route is set on paper. Outside silence, glass at the back, small goods lifted, and a fast exit. The house gives no voice to motive, only to method. The next name will not come from wood and glass. It will come from a person who points us back to this floor plan and makes it personal. For 4 years after the homicide, no one was arrested. The opinion states the suspect eluded apprehension for these crimes for 4 years. Body content. I mark the calendar gap the record confirms. The file did not produce an arrest from late 1996 through late 2000. That span is the only concrete status the court provides for the investigation during those years. The absence of an arrest matters. It fixes the case as open and cold by the time the fourth winter came. It also frames why the later shift carried weight at trial and on appeal. The court summarizes the early period in a single line, so I do the same. No added leads. No added theories. Only the state of the case. No apprehension for 4 years. The appellate record notes a practical limit. Parts of the trial transcript were incomplete due to equipment failure, and the parties filed a verified statement of the evidence. That explains why some day-to-day investigative steps are not laid out in detail on appeal. I keep to what is on the page. I add one boundary note to guide later chapters. If a fact is not in the opinion or other primary record, it does not belong here. This chapter holds the gap only. The next chapter will carry the moment when the file moves again. The case sits through 4 winters without an arrest. Then, in late 2000, a single interview changes the file's temperature. On October 26th, 2000, a girlfriend sat in an interview room and named the man who went through the back window. Her name was Angela Stone. The interviewer was Indiana State Police Detective Mark R. Heffelfinger. Body content. I log the interview first. The opinion fixes the date, the witness, and the detective. It states that during questioning, Stone implicated Donald Earl Hauser in the burglary and the homicide. I keep the scope tight to those points. No added lines. No added motives. Only the identification and the source. Next, I mark the action the interview triggered. The same day, officers executed a search warrant at Hauser's mother's home in LaGrange County. They recovered silverware taken from Julia Gert's house. The record adds one detail that ties the items to the suspect by conduct, not rumor. He had given the silverware to his mother as a Christmas gift. That makes the link concrete without any flourish. Interview. Warrant. Recovery. Gift. Each word is in the file. I separate what belongs here from what belongs later. The opinion notes a follow-on event the next day involving Hauser and Detective Heffelfinger. This chapter holds the interview that produced the lead and the same-day recovery only. The questioning of the suspect and anything he said sits in the next chapter. I log the boundary so the record stays clean. Two case uses arise from the silverware. First, it corroborates the interview without relying on character evidence. The items match the property list set out in the court's background. Second, the location of the recovery places the goods in a family setting, which supports the gift detail the opinion records. I note both uses and stop there. There is no need to describe packaging, serial numbers, or a chain of custody beyond what the court includes. I write one sentence for the affidavit trail, an interview that names a suspect, names the crime, and points to stolen property supports a warrant. The opinion confirms that the warrant issued and that officers found the property that day. I do not add language about the probable cause narrative since the opinion does not quote it. By nightfall on October 26th, the case had a named suspect and stolen silverware back in evidence bags. The room with the curtain stain now had a path to a person. The next step is the interview room where the named man takes a seat. October 27th, 2000. Detective Mark R. Heffelfinger questioned Donald Earl Hauser. Officers had brought Hauser to Noble County from Otter Creek Correctional Facility in Kentucky, where he served a burglary sentence. During this interview, Hauser confessed to burglarizing Julia Gert's home and killing her by suffocating her with a pillow. Body content. I logged the location and custody first. The interview took place after a transport from Kentucky to Indiana. The record names Otter Creek Correctional Facility and confirms a pending burglary sentence in Kentucky. This fixes status, movement, and jurisdiction for the day in question. Scope next. The opinion states a plain admission. Hauser said he went into the home and ended a life with a pillow. No embellishment appears in the text. I keep the admission in the same simple form. Entry, property crime, suffocation. One sequence inside one room. I mark the chain across two dates. October 26th produced a name and stolen silverware from a family home. October 27th produced a confession from the named person. This two-step moves the case from inference to direct words from the suspect. The opinion also notes a record gap at trial. Part of the transcript failed, so the parties filed a verified statement of the evidence. For this chapter, I rely on the appellate summary only. No added quotes from an unavailable tape. No invented phrasing. The safe ground is the court's line on what Hauser admitted. I picture the room only in broad strokes, since the opinion gives no stage directions. A table, two chairs, a recorder. A form for rights and a signature line. The narrative stays inside the four corners of the appellate text. The purpose here is to place words in the record, not to build mood. Why this interview mattered appears later in a single paragraph on harmless error. The court weighed a contested exhibit and then set it aside as minor next to two heavy points. A confession to burglary and suffocation, and blood on a curtain near the entry. The second point belongs to Chapter 1. The first point lives here. Together, they shrink the role of side issues at trial. I enter the admission into the outline with tight edges. He said he broke in. He said he placed a pillow over the victim's face. The opinion does not give a quote for wording or tone, so I do not write one. The admission stands as a fact, not a performance. I add two procedural notes for context. First, the interrogation followed a same-week warrant and evidence recovery linked to the crime scene inventory, which supports sequencing without repeating the list here. Second, the interview occurred while Hauser was already in custody on another case, which explains transport and security. Both notes stay within the opinion's lines. Any claims about influence, state of mind, or substances belong to the defense chapter, not here. This chapter holds the state's cleanest piece of direct evidence from the suspect's own mouth. I leave every argument about weight and reliability for later, where the court addresses those points. I close my notebook on the interview with one sentence written in block letters. Words matter when paper supports them. Here, the paper says the suspect confessed to the break-in and to smothering an elderly woman with a pillow. The house told part of the story. The interview filled the rest. The tape clicks off. A transport chain and a short interview now sit beside a curtain stain. The next voice the jury hears will not come from a detective. It will come from a witness who once shared a life with the suspect. Angela Stone sits on the stand. The prosecutor asks if Hauser talked about killing. She answers, yes. What did he say? Just that there would be no survivors. Did he talk about a specific way? It was hands-on. That means you are more of a man, where if you use a gun and shoot him. TR 440 to 441. Body content. I logged the purpose first. The state offered this testimony to show intent. It argued the statements made it more probable that Hauser intended to kill Julia Gert during the burglary. The point was simple. His own words about method and outcome fit a choice to leave no witness alive. Next, I record the defense response. Hauser argued the testimony had little or no relevance to this homicide and that the state used it to paint him as someone with a general propensity to kill. The brief said the state tried to convince the jury he would kill anyone who got in his way. That is the defense frame in the appellate record. The appellate court treated this issue like the lyrics issue in the same section of the opinion. It did not decide a Rule 402 or 404 dispute in detail because the trial objection preserved only relevance. The court asked a narrower question. Did the admission of this testimony affect substantial rights in light of the whole record? Its answer was no. The panel labeled any error harmless. I keep my focus on why the court reached that result. Two anchors reduce the weight of stones, no survivors, and hands on lines. First, Hauser had confessed to burglarizing the home and suffocating the victim with a pillow. Second, his blood was on the curtain at the entry window. Those points sit in the opinion a few lines above the stone ruling and frame the harmlessness analysis that follows. When direct admissions and physical transfer fix the core facts, a general statement about method and resolve does less work. For the outline, I mark what this testimony is and is not. It is not a confession. It is not a timeline. It is not a step-by-step. It is a window into attitude and method as told by a girlfriend under oath. It carries risk of unfair character use if it floats free of context. The court acknowledged that tension in the neighboring discussion of relevance and propensity in the opinion. But here, the strength of the core evidence limited its impact. The court left the verdict in place. I add one procedural guardrail for this chapter only. I repeat Stone's words once because they are the substance at issue. I do not reuse them later. They live here and only here. If I reference them again, it will be in one line and only to note that the appellate court found no effect on substantial rights. That preserves the no overlap rule and keeps each chapter clean. Finally, I note why this matters to a listener. Juries hear more than lab reports and chain of custody forms. They hear how a person spoke about violence before the crime. The law lets some of that in when it ties to intent. The risk is that it becomes a shortcut to bad person, bad act. The appellate court's job was to test the link. In this case, the hard proof made the difference, so the testimony did not move the legal needle. The record uses that outcome to keep the focus on the confession and the curtain stain. The jury heard no survivors and hands-on. The law heard strong proof elsewhere and called those lines harmless against the whole file. The next exhibit draws the same analysis, but from a different source. It is not speech about method. It is a set of song lyrics the state tied to intent, and the court pushed to the side. Detective Mark Heffelfinger told the jury that Angela Stone said Hauser listened to Night Prowler by AC/DC. The state offered the song's printed lyrics as an exhibit to show intent. The court admitted them over a relevance objection. Body content. I fix the record first. The opinion names the song, the source of the tip, and the exhibit number. It states the prosecutor argued the lyrics were relevant to prove intent for burglary and murder. The trial judge overruled the defense on relevance and allowed the text in. Next, the standard. Indiana Evidence Rule 401 asks if the item has any tendency to make a consequential fact more probable. The opinion says as a general point, there is no link between liking a song and doing what it describes, though relevance has a low bar. The court then notes that Hauser did not preserve Rule 403 or 404 grounds at trial, so the only live question on appeal was relevance and, if error, whether the exhibit affected substantial rights. What the lyrics said matters only at a high level. The court summarized them as describing a person who prowls at night, forces entry, and harms the target. I do not quote the lines here, only the court summary. The jurors heard Stone say the song was about sneaking around. That testimony came in before the exhibit. Now the ruling that controls this chapter. The court held that even if admitting the lyrics was error, it was harmless. It reached that result for two reasons already in this record. Hauser admitted in questioning that he burglarized the home and suffocated the victim with a pillow. His blood was on the curtain at the entry window. Against that proof, the probable impact of a rock song's text was sufficiently minor and did not affect substantial rights. Verdicts stand. I add one clarity line on names. The opinion identifies the victim as Mary Lou Gehrt. I use the court's name going forward. The age, location, and facts align with the earlier chapters. The correction here keeps the record exact. For the outline, I keep tight edges. This chapter holds only the music exhibit, the preserved objection, and the harmless error analysis. I do not restate the confession content beyond one line or the curtain finding beyond one line, since both sit in earlier chapters as primary proof. The function here is to explain why a dramatic exhibit at trial did not move the legal needle on appeal. A song made it into evidence. The verdict did not depend on it. The law measured the exhibit against a confession and a stain on fabric and called any error harmless. The next chapter turns to the defense story about state of mind during the interview that produced those admissions. On the stand, Hauser said he had taken LSD shortly before Detective Heffelfinger questioned him, and that he did not remember the interview. He also said drugs were available while he was incarcerated in Kentucky. Body content. I log his claims in plain order. First, he told the jury he ingested LSD before questioning. He linked the drug to lethargy, confusion, and poor awareness. He said he lacked memory of the interview. He added that he tried to call his mother before the interview, but was told to wait. He said inmates could get illegal drugs while locked up. Each of these points appears in the court's summary of his testimony. Next, I record the legal consequence of those claims. Because Hauser himself volunteered that he used LSD while incarcerated shortly before the interview, the state was allowed to ask about the circumstances of his drug access and his incarceration status. The appellate court found no abuse of discretion in letting the jury hear that he was in a Kentucky prison and in permitting questions that probed the details he raised. I keep the scope tight. This chapter is not about voluntariness rulings or Miranda disputes. The opinion segment here addresses something narrower. It explains why the state could counter Hauser's own narrative about drugs and memory with questions he made relevant when he testified. The court's reasoning is direct. He opened the door. The trial judge let the state walk through it. The appellate court agreed. Now I place this in the file's larger weight, without repeating earlier chapters. The panel's analysis of other issues shows where the case rested. A confession to burglary and suffocation sat in the record. Blood on a curtain at the entry window tied the scene to the same person. Against proof like that, disputes about what the jury heard regarding his incarceration did not move the verdict. That is the court's posture across the opinion. I add two boundaries for accuracy. I do not quote the interview because the appellate text does not provide a transcript line for his words in the room that day. I do not add any medical claims about LSD effects beyond the phrasing the court used. This chapter logs only what the opinion reports and why those lines mattered to what the jury could hear. The narrative purpose is simple. Jurors heard Hauser's story about his state of mind. The state met it with context he created, including his incarceration and claimed drug access. The appellate court upheld that choice by the trial judge. The result leaves his admission and the physical transfer untouched. Those anchors sit elsewhere in this story and in the opinion. The defense offered a memory gap and a drug claim. The court let the jury hear how that gap might have existed and where he was when he said he used the drug. The next chapter moves to what the jury decided on November 12, 2002. November 12, 2002. The jury returned guilty verdicts on both counts, knowing or intentional murder and burglary causing death. Body content. The form of the verdicts matters. Murder required proof of a killing done knowingly or intentionally. Burglary causing death required proof of a break-in with the added outcome that a person died. By finding guilt on both, the jury accepted each element as charged. The calendar note is exact. The verdicts came first. Any punishment decision came later and belongs in the next chapter. I keep the record here to the two words that close a trial on facts. Guilty on murder, guilty on burglary causing death. The court's summary fixes the sequence in a way that helps a listener keep track. Trial on liability through November 12th. Penalty phase begins the next day. Sentencing comes later. This chapter stops at the moment the clerk read the two verdicts into the record. I add one clarity line on names used in the opinion. The background section identifies the victim as Julia Gert. The conclusion section refers to Mary Lou Gert. External records and the background paragraph support Julia L. Gert, age 86, in Noble County, as the victim. I will follow the background naming while noting the opinion's inconsistency. Two signed verdicts set the stage for what comes next. The jury would return to the courtroom the next morning for the penalty phase. The jury came back the next morning for the penalty phase. Three forms sat in front of them. They found the aggravator proven beyond a reasonable doubt. They found the aggravator outweighed any mitigators. They recommended life without parole. On February 4th, 2003, the judge imposed life without parole for murder and 20 years for burglary. Body content. I marked the aggravator first. The state charged murder during the commission of burglary under Indiana Code 35-50-2-9b. 1b. The jury said the state met that burden. The opinion places that finding in clear lines. The panel later calls the weight of that aggravator high. I record both points here because they define the sentence that followed. Mitigation came next. The defense offered childhood abuse, a diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder, and a history of substance abuse. The court grouped these and assigned very low weight to the combination. That language fixes scale on the record. High weight on the charged aggravator, low weight on the mitigators. The jury's forms mattered. One form found the aggravator proven. One form found it outweighed mitigators. One form recommended life without parole. Those are distinct acts. Proof. Weighing. Recommendation. The judge then adopted the recommendation and pronounced sentence on February 4, 2003. The burglary count drew a separate 20-year term. I log how this chapter fits the arc without repeating earlier proof. The penalty phase did not retry the confession or the curtain stain. Those lived in the liability phase. The penalty question asked what the crime's circumstances required as punishment. The record shows a unanimous finding on the burglary murder aggravator and a unanimous weighing outcome. That is why the recommendation flowed in the same direction. I keep a note on the name issue for consistency. The background section identifies the victim as Julia Gert. The conclusion section uses Mary Lou Gert. External references support Julia L. Gert as the victim in Noble County. I continue with the background naming while acknowledging the internal inconsistency in the opinion. The jury signed three times. The judge spoke once and set the sentence that would not end. The legal fight moved to appellate papers. The facts that drove the sentence stayed where they were placed on those forms. March 10, 2005. The Indiana Supreme Court affirmed the convictions and the life without parole sentence. Body content. I log the three live issues the opinion resolves. First, the ex post facto claim. In 2002, the legislature amended Indiana Code 35-50-2-9e, so a judge must follow a jury's life without parole recommendation. Hauser argued the older version should apply because the crime occurred in 1996. The court pointed to Helsley and Stroud and rejected the claim. The newer rule controlled at sentencing and did not violate ex post facto limits. Second, the Ring question. Hauser argued that Ring versus Arizona required a jury to find, beyond a reasonable doubt and unanimously, that aggravation outweighed mitigation before life without parole. The court cited Ritchie and held that Ring requires jury finding of the qualifying aggravator, not a separate beyond a reasonable doubt finding on weighing. The aggravator here was murder during burglary, which the jury found beyond a reasonable doubt. Third, Indiana double jeopardy. Hauser said the burglary could not both support a burglary conviction and serve as the aggravator for life without parole. The court relied on Overstreet and West and said death or life sentencing is a distinct scheme. The aggravator narrows eligibility and is not the same as the offense elements for double jeopardy purposes. The burglary conviction and the life sentence both stand. The court also addressed trial evidence complaints. It treated the AC/DC Night Prowler lyrics and Angela Stone's No Survivors and hands-on statements as, at worst, harmless in light of two anchors already in the record. Hauser's confession to burglary and suffocation, and his blood on the curtain at the entry window. On sentence review under Appellate Rule 7b, the court weighed the charged aggravator in the high range and the mitigation in the very low range. It affirmed life without parole for murder and the separate 20-year term for burglary. The opinion leaves no loose thread on law or facts. The jury's findings hold. The sentence holds. The file moves from trial boxes to an affirmed judgment dated March 10, 2005. March 10, 2005 closed the legal loop. The Indiana Supreme Court affirmed the guilty verdicts and the life without parole sentence. Body content. The opinion fixed what mattered for the record. It placed the murder inside a burglary and kept the punishment that followed. It did this in plain lines. A jury heard the case. It found guilt on November 12, 2002. It reconvened the next morning. It found the charged aggravator. It weighed mitigation low. It recommended life without parole. The judge imposed that sentence on February 4, 2003, along with 20 years for burglary. The High Court left those outcomes in place. The court also set boundaries on evidence fights from trial. The state had offered AC/DC lyrics tied to intent. The state had offered Angela Stone's lines about no survivors and hands-on. The court said even if these raised relevance concerns, any error was harmless against two anchors. Hauser admitted he burglarized the home and suffocated the victim with a pillow. His blood was on a curtain at the entry window. The lyrics and the lines did not move the legal needle because the hard proof already filled the scale. Three appellate claims defined the rest of the ruling. On ex post facto, the court rejected the challenge to the sentencing statute that required the judge to follow a jury's life without parole recommendation. The law in place at sentencing controlled. On the Sixth Amendment question from Ring, the court said the jury had to find the aggravator beyond a reasonable doubt, not the weighing step beyond a reasonable doubt. The jury did find the aggravator. On Indiana double jeopardy, the court said using burglary as the aggravator while also entering a burglary judgment did not violate the rule. Death and life without parole schemes are separate in purpose. The court cited its own cases and affirmed. The opinion also recorded a practical fact about the file. Part of the trial transcript failed due to equipment issues. The parties filed a verified statement of the evidence under Appellate Rule 31. The court still had enough to decide every claim. That note explains why this story uses the opinion's clear summary lines and avoids any invented dialogue from missing pages. Why the curtain detail endures is simple. It links the place where a body must pass to a person who later confessed. It is a transfer point you can point to without drama. The sentence that captures it is short. His blood was found on a curtain where he gained entrance to the victim's house. That line compresses lab work, chain of custody, and scene photos into a fact a jury can hold. The appellate court used it the same way to show why side issues were small. The name in the conclusion section reads Mary Lou Gehrt. The background section and the case history fix Julia Gehrt, age 86, in rural Noble County. The body of the opinion aligns with Julia. I keep that name for accuracy and note the internal misprint at the end. The holdings do not change with the label, but the person deserves the right name here. The chapter does not reach for what the court does not say. It does not speak for the town. It does not claim private grief. It sets the legal finish. A jury found guilt. A jury found an aggravator. A judge imposed life without parole. A high court affirmed. The file moved from trial boxes to a judgment that stands. The law wrote the last page. The house with the cut line and the broken back window no longer carried an open case. The fabric by. The frame kept its meaning. The record kept the rest.